Hush, 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 here comes the boogeyman. Don't let him come too close to you. He'll catch you if he can.
Welcome to Boggart and the Banshee, a supernatural podcast. I'm Chris, the relentlessly informative. I study ghosts, Fortiana, fashion history, and death.
And I'm Simon, Chris's worst nightmare. I study boggarts, fairies, urban legends, and the impossible.
Chris, it's great to be back.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better, and I hope the family's feeling better.
Yeah, we've had this awful bout of the flu, I'm afraid. But tell me about yourself. I know that you've been fairly active on our Facebook group.
Well, it's really fascinating, the questions people ask about just sort of a follow-up. And it's really been intriguing to see the questions that people have or new information that they've added.
I think if you judge social media in terms of I learn things here, then the Boggart and Banshee Facebook page is one of the very best places I've been. And already this month, I've changed my mind on a couple of issues thanks to contributions there.
Yes, it's really been enlightening.
This time when we put the episode out, I'll actually put the Facebook link on the descriptor page for the podcast. So anyone who wants to come along and contribute to the group would be very welcome to.
Excellent. Excellent.
What about today, Chris? What treat have you got? It's your turn to take us around the mountain.
We're going to talk about fairy artifacts. We'll be talking about objects given by the fairies or stolen from the fairies, that sort of thing.
It's got to be something from the world of fairies that sometimes or somehow ends up among human beings. So that would include, I imagine, fairy shop, for example, fairy money.
Well, I'm looking at things that still exist that have the tradition of being handed down or stolen from the fairies, actual artifacts. And we have lots of stories about people who were, say, gifted a set of pipes or given money, but then it disappeared. So those are interesting stories, but I want to see an actual physical artifact.
Right. So an artifact, it's got to be something that we can go to a museum or go to a family home and touch.
Right.
Well, great. You want to set us off with one of your readings then?
This comes from Folklore of Nova Scotia by Mary L. Fraser. Another fairy tale has been handed down in Mr. Murphy's family for generations. A great-great-granduncle of his went out to work in a field near the shore one day. Soon he perceived a little man seated out at a nearby headland. Curious to see what the little creature was doing, he walked up to him and found him making a little shoe, into which he was putting the most beautiful work imaginable. Work could only be done by fairy fingers. "How I wish I could make a shoe like that," he exclaimed. "I am not so good a shoemaker as the man behind you," answered the fairy. The man, who was versed in fairy ways, knew that the fairy wished to distract his attention in order to escape, so instead of looking behind, he seized the shoe and made off with it. The shoe was kept in his family as a very precious heirloom. He regretted very much that he did not bring it with him to this country. He often described to his grandchildren its beautiful, delicate workmanship.
Well, that gives me a much better idea of what you're looking for. So the important thing here is not just that we get something from the fairies, but that it's actually kept within the family. So it really is an heirloom. I suppose, for instance, very common in fairy stories from Britain and Ireland is the idea of fairies giving food either as a trick or as a reward. But that, for example, wouldn't work by your definition.
No, there's an odd convention to do with fairy food. Obviously, it's not something you want to ingest if you're under the fairy mound at the fairy feast. You'll be kept there forever. But if it's given as a reward, there's a delightful story of a man who heard somebody crying and found a tiny spade at Wickbarrow, and he repaired the spade and later found a cake in the same spot. He ate it and prospered ever after. And it's okay to eat it if the food is a reward for helping the good people.
But Chris, we're about 4 minutes into this podcast and we're already going to have a disagreement. Because the story that you're referring to, which is sometimes called the fairy peel, I know about 20 different versions of that from Britain, and it is a beautiful story. Yes. But what's always confused me is that the fairy food seems to have different effects in different stories, and it seems to be very unfair on the part of the fairies not to play straight. Sometimes they offer food to the individual or the individual and his friend. And there is a story where, for example, the individual gives it to his horse who dies. There's another one where the friend who hasn't helped with the spade dies.
Yes.
There's one where both of them die, even though the man helped with the fairy spade.
Oh, you've disillusioned me terribly here.
Well, but as always with fairies, there are rules. It's just that we don't know them. They are rotters. They are very difficult in this way.
We probably can't do better than to quote Sir Walter Scott from Letters on Demonology and Witchcraft. Although their gifts were sometimes valuable, they were usually wantonly given and unexpectedly resumed.
Hmm.
Don't talk about fairy gifts. If you find a silver shilling on the fairy mound each time you pass, you'd better not mention it, because if you do, no more silver for you. All the cases we read about boasting about money from the fairies would just guarantee that you lose everything.
Well, let me ask you a question then. What happens to two naive folklorists who do a podcast on fairy artifacts if they break fairy taboo for about an hour speaking about the said artifacts?
Well, we don't possess those. Well, maybe you do. I don't know. I don't have any.
I'm not saying anything, Chris. Okay.
Okay. Fair enough. We went through this with the podcast episode on luck. It's bad luck to talk about luck. But I think we're on safe ground here if you don't admit that you possess anything from the judge.
Okay. This sounds a useful compromise. I suppose one kind of almost fairy artifact, if I've got the sense of your definition, would be that in some parts of Lowland Scotland, and I think in Cornwall, there are traditions of people who have managed to get a mermaid's comb. Or if it's not a mermaid, it's anyway one of the water kelpies in Lowland Scotland. It's some kind of object associated with the hair, and it's kept in families, and in families it becomes the source of the family's power for healing. Mm-hmm. They're a healing family. Would that work as an example of a fairy artifact for you?
Absolutely. Some of the other things I've heard about being given, obviously cattle, and those are capriciously given. You know, when the person they're given to dies, they go back into the lake or something. Silver chanter, a pipe chanter, and that still exists in one family. Harps are another popular fairy gift. Pipes, in terms of actual smoking pipes.
I have to admit my ignorance here, but what is a silver chanter?
The thing that you blow into for bagpipes.
I understand.
It looks a bit like a recorder. It's got holes and
you finger the
tune that way.
Of the examples you've given there, cattle is a little bit of an unusual instance.
Yeah.
But I think in some of the Welsh stories, there's the idea isn't that the cattle disappear, but their blood has gone into the local cattle stock. And so the family has better cattle from then on forth.
I thought that they all disappeared. Anything that had the fairy blood, the fairy cattle blood, would actually be taken back. There's a lot of stories like this, and they always seem to lose the cattle in the end.
There is... a lovely human parallel to that, though. There's a fascinating North Welsh source from the 19th century where a man talks about how his great-great-great-great-grandmother was a fairy. And he has this beautiful line, because she came out of a lake, had kids with his great-great-great-great-granddad, and of course eventually disappeared. But he finishes the description with this outstanding line. He says, "The best blood in me is fairy blood. Sometimes the blood of the fairy seems to seep into the world."
Yes. And that's a whole different case where you're, you know, a man and a fairy woman or vice versa interbreed. Yes, that's a whole different case than the cattle, because the cattle is just taken away.
Okay.
It was a temporary gift.
Well, look, so we'll have to leave fairy wives for another day, but maybe I could start by talking about one of my favourite fairy artefacts that you, in fact, have already introduced. And these are fairy shoes.
And do you have some?
Well, I know about 7 examples, and you have now given me an 8th example, albeit from across the Atlantic, at least when it was written down. And these examples, I think I'm right in saying, are all from Ireland. And for reasons I can't quite understand, most of them are from Ulster, Ulster being one of the four quarters, the traditional four quarters of Ireland. They're associated, as in your story, with leprechauns. So, of course, there's the idea in Irish folklore that you meet a leprechaun, and if you can lay hold on him, if you can keep hold of him, you'll be able to get his treasure. And this business of finding the shoe seems to be some mutation of this legend, that someone comes home with the shoe. But what I find fascinating is these are not just stories. I have newspapers from the 1960s and, God help us, the 1970s, where Ulster journalists went out and photographed little shoes in Irish families, shoes that had been handed down as heirlooms because great-granddad or great-great-grandma managed to grab a shoe from a leprechaun. And Chris, you'll be much better at this than me. But when you look at the photographs, they seem fairly, I mean, they're material. Okay, they've clearly been made with by someone with talent. My favorite example, and the only concrete case that I know of from outside of Ireland, coincidentally comes from Nova Scotia as well. However, your story was about someone remembering the old land back in Ireland. This story is about someone who found a shoe in Nova Scotia. And this shoe still survives, but it's different from the others. It's not made of textiles. It's allegedly made of moss. And this shoe was rescued, kept in a family for 30 years. It was a little the worse for wear at the end of that time. And it is now kept by the family in a large test tube. And I've seen photographs of this shoe. And between you and me, Chris, I can tell you that it looks like a little lump of moss. But there you are. So, Chris, how do you explain these shoes that clearly have a physical existence? I'm going to venture, perhaps risking the fairies' wrath, that these are not really the shoes of leprechauns. So how on earth do you explain these objects that are 1 or 2 inches across with careful needlework? What can we say about them?
Right. One of them that supposedly was found in Ireland on a remote sheep track in 1835 was supposedly taken to America, and it was thought to be of mouse skin. It was examined by Harvard University scientists, supposedly. Now, the explanation is probably disconcertingly simple. I just wonder if some of these were simply the equivalent of carnival gaffes. You find a shoemaker to make the tiniest shoe you can find, then you age it and display it with a leprechaun backstory. It's sort of the footwear equivalent of the Fiji mermaid. on the other hand,
sorry, this is brilliant. Excuse me.
On the other hand, I spoke with Valentine Povinelli, master of the shoemaking shop at Colonial Williamsburg, and he showed me a photo of some tiny boots in their museum collection. And he made the excellent suggestion that miniature shoes might be a pocket talisman.
Oh.
He also said that it wasn't uncommon for apprentices to learn by making shoes for their fellow children. You know, the child's going to outgrow the shoe before wearing it out, so it doesn't have to be perfect. But these don't look like children's shoes. They're really, really tiny. And just like there's people who like to write the Ten Commandments on a grain of rice or put ships in a bottle, there are people who like to see how small they can make common items. Mm-hmm. And I also spoke to D.A. Segudo, who was Master Emeritus of the shoemaking shop at Williamsburg, and he said, of course the shoe was never worn. It was just scuffed enough to look that way. Shoemakers all over occasionally turned their hands in boredom to making miniature shoes. When shoemaking business was slow, just make a tiny leprechaun shoe or three out of scraps leather off the floor.
I find this last point really interesting because this was the closest idea I'd come to in my mind, though you have all the heavy artillery of the experts to back you up here. But I remember that when we did the episode on the famous Edinburgh coffins, we came across a couple of examples of young apprentices in woodwork being asked to make miniature coffins as a form of training. And I wondered if perhaps this was a job given to an apprentice to use up some scrap and just test some very basic skills at the beginning. So maybe somewhere between these closely related motives, we find our explanation. I should also throw in, though, just in case anyone is rolling their eyes, as Chris says, that, well, we have a leprechaun shoe, we can now display it to the general public. These shoes were indeed displayed to the general public. We have several references to them, including one of them being displayed in the window of a newspaper office. And again, if you're thinking, oh, for God's sake, we have a report from the 1870s, again from Ulster, of a leprechaun actually being captured and displayed. And this leprechaun seems to have been a very small man with rather unusual clothes on. And the journalist adds rather waspishly and with a very strong Cork accent, which is the other side of Ireland. But just to give you an idea that this was stuff that people were still taking seriously in the 19th century.
And to be fair, you know, living mermaids were actually displayed. Now, whether they were real mermaids, you know, we have our doubts, but it was a popular attraction. The other possibility for these shoes is that they were shoes for fashion figures. They had relatively large scale fashion dolls called Pandoras, and it's possible that these were used for that. Or we also know that some Virgin Mary statues and the Christ Child had their own shoes. So
really?
It's a possibility, especially in Ireland.
Yes.
But it would be odd to find something you purloined from the Christ Child being attributed to a leprechaun.
Sorry, Chris, you've got to think I'm recovering from flu. You just can't make me laugh too much. Okay. So please go. Here we go. Go easy on me, please. Are you serious that people used to make shoes for the Virgin Mary and for the Christ Child?
Oh, yes, yes.
So you'd have a porcelain statue and you would put real shoes on?
Well, you put real clothes on everybody. You put shoes, crowns, jewelry, and dresses and capes. Those survive in church inventories, and in some churches they've still got the garments. Yeah, very, very common. It's more of a Mediterranean custom, but it was found both in England and in Ireland.
And like you say, in Ireland, this is where we find the shoes. So there's a real possibility there. Chris, when you were talking about the shoes, I heard that little tone that creeps into your voice sometimes when you're talking about anything to do with clothes. And that as a rather fashion-dead individual, I find mysterious, but I've now learned to recognize. And I just wonder on that subject, are there other examples of fairy clothes or maybe fairy textiles? I was thinking there's the famous fairy flag of Dunvegan, for example. Can you give any other examples in that kind of area?
I can give you an example of a set of fairy clothing. There are some fairy cloths, and we'll talk about the fairy flags in a moment. But the story about the leprechaun suit is early in 1989, it was reported in the local press that a man named O'Hare, who owned a pub in County Louth, saw strange lights on the mountain one dark December morning and went to investigate, accompanied by a friend. They said as they reached the mountain gate, they saw the lights. There was no sound, an eerie silence. We walked towards the light and we continued on to where they had been. And to our utter amazement, we found what we can only describe as leprechaun clothes. There were gold sovereigns in the left-hand pocket of the trouser, To the left of where the clothes lay, the ground was scorched, and on the scorched ground lay bones. We gathered them up and headed back down the mountain, and that's it, the whole story. The finds were later displayed, and Carlingford got lots of publicity. It later transpired that the whole story started as a marketing ploy organized by the local tourist association. So now there's a leprechaun and fairy cavern and folklore park there. They have a picture of the suit on the site, but I'm not sure it's the same.
I imagine that that leprechaun suit was displayed in the gentleman's pub for several weeks as well.
Yes,
indeed. I'm sure that everyone came out a winner. Yes. It's interesting how leprechauns seem to be particularly important in the world of fairy artifacts, because there were also a couple of cases, I think two cases, of leprechaun hammers. Yeah. Because you can imagine, if part of the story is the leprechaun is making the shoe, I grab the shoe, as your gentleman did in the original tale, then, of course, it makes perfect sense that if the leprechaun has a hammer as well with the shoe, then grab that too.
It's a ubiquitous story. Even Tolkien, he read to the Lovelace Club at Oxford in 1938. He produced a leprechaun's shoe, which he declared to be genuine.
Yes.
And this guy reported this in the biography, Humphrey Carpenter's bio of Tolkien. So what was he doing carrying a leprechaun shoe around?
I can actually beat you there, Chris. This rarely happens, but let me just enjoy this moment. I have a source from the late 19th century where there was a gentleman in one of the Suffolk market towns, and a folklorist was talking to him. And the gentleman, they were talking about supernatural beings, and the gentleman emptied his pocket, and in the pocket there was the usual scrabble and, you know, little bits of stone, seeds, a coin. There was also a miniature foot, and the man in question said, "Do you know what this is?" And the folklorist said, "I have no idea." And the man said, "It's a fairy foot."
Whoa.
Yeah, can you, I mean, talk about getting on the fairy's nerves. He put it back in his pocket and walked away, and that was the end of it. And the folklorist tentatively suggested that it might have been a mole's foot.
Yes.
But the only information he could get out of the man was that it was good for arthritis. So if anyone suffers from arthritis out there, I'm thinking perhaps of my mom, then you need a fairy foot.
Well, that's taking fairy artifacts to an entire different level.
Yes, it is.
Well, back to fairy fabric. We're on maybe safer ground with that. According to legend, a woman from an Icelandic farm, and I'm hoping I'm not pronouncing this badly, Prestafiat in the east of Iceland, received a cloth as payment from a fairy woman who she'd midwifed. The cloth is now in the National Museum of Iceland. And Thor Magnusson, who was the custodian of antiquities, said, "Certainly it's a unique cloth, but it often happened in the old days that if people did not remember or could not explain the true origin of a rare item, they claimed that the fairies had made it." Unfortunately, I haven't been able to actually take a look at this cloth. It's not on their website. You know, perhaps I'll be able to get in touch with them in the future to actually see it. I like his explanation that if people couldn't remember or couldn't explain it, they'd claim that the fairies had made it, because that applies to the fairy flag of Dunvegan Castle. The MacLeods came into possession of it, they say, about the end of the 14th century, in the time of John, who was the fourth chief. It's a brownish silk fabric. It was once bright yellow, and there used to be gold crosses embroidered on it. There are also what are described as red elf spots, but they seem to be darnings. Sir Reginald MacLeod took it to the South Kensington Museum, it's now the V&A, to ask their opinion about its origin. They said it was probably Eastern silk and had been brought back from the Crusades as a trophy, and the elf spots were beautiful Eastern darns. Mm. Sir Reginald said, "You believe it to be a relic of the Crusades. I know it was given to my ancestor by the fairies."
Hmm.
And the curator replied, "I bow to your superior knowledge, Sir Reginald." Now, there's a couple of origin stories for the fairy flag. One was it was given to a MacLeod by a fairy bride, and after 20 years of married life with him, she was forced to return to fairyland. So when she said farewell at the local fairy bridge, she gave him the flag with the promise that when it was waved in times of danger or distress, fairy help would be forthcoming to save the clan. Or, two, it was found wrapped about a baby MacLeod heir. The constant in the stories is a promise that on three occasions, the waving of the flag will bring help, and frivolous waving of the flag brings disaster. Sir Walter Scott visited the castle in 1814 and said that, produced in battle, the flag multiplied the number of the MacLeods. Spread on the nuptial bed, it ensured fertility. And lastly, it brought herring into the loch.
Chris, can I just make a complaint here?
Yes.
You have out-Walter Scotted me. I had one quotation I wanted to read today, and it was that one.
I'm sorry.
So, as the great MacLeod said, I submit to your superior knowledge here.
Well, the flag was examined again by the V&A, and they concluded it was woven in either Syria or Rhodes, and it was made in the Near East. So it was his opinion that the flag in its original state would have been very precious, something maybe a relic from a saint rather than an actual flag. Apparently, the estate office website claims that experts have dated the flag to the 4th and 7th century, which is kind of improbable.
Although extraordinary.
Another tradition suggests an origin in a purported Scandinavian ancestor, Harald Hardrada, King of Norway. He supposedly visited Constantinople and served with the imperial Byzantine bodyguard, and he was said to have a magic banner, which, when waved, brought victory. So who knows whether, you know, this was actually something brought back from the Crusades. I bow to the expert, the textile experts at the V&A personally.
My favorite story about the fairy flag of Dunvegan is that in the Second World War, members of the clan were, depending on the story you read, allowed to take either fragments of the flag with them on British bombers or photographs of flag with them on British bombers. And this beautiful idea, who knows if it's true, but that this artifact that, as you say, might go back to the late antique period in the Mediterranean was protecting Scottish airmen in the Second World War is just absolutely extraordinary. But there you are. I like very much your idea that often we give the name fairy to things that aren't familiar, that look a little bit exotic, and all the better if perhaps they're slightly, for Britain and Ireland, on the small side. And I think that that's certainly true of, for example, we already talked about fairy shot. These are the small arrowheads that are picked up on British and Irish moors, and they're often claimed to be the missiles of the fairies. Mm-hmm. It was true of the so-called fairy pipes. These were pipes that were being dug up in the 19th century, but they were actually the first pipes that were used in Britain to smoke tobacco back in the early, well, the 1600s and the very early 1700s, these tiny, tiny pipes. And you also have fairy money, so-called, which typically were Roman coins. Moving away from textiles, one other example I can give you of an exotic object that was given a fairy origin. And this is an object called the Luck of Edenhall.
Yes.
And the Luck of Edenhall is this beautiful, beautiful piece of glasswork from Edenhall in Cumbria. And it's essentially a cup. It's not even a particularly small cup. And experts at the V&A, I have my own experts, Chris, just remember this. Experts at the V&A tell us that it was made in the 14th century Arabic world, probably in Egypt or Syria. It's very likely, not that it was brought back from the Crusades, but it was brought back somehow with the post-Crusade contacts with the Middle East, ended up at the far end of the Christian world in Cumberland in Britain. And the family at Edenhall who took possession of the cup had a story that one of their ancestors had stolen it from a fairy party in the grounds of the house. And every time I look at this cup, as I'm speaking to you now, I have a beautiful colour photograph of it in front of me. My first reaction is not how beautiful it is, though it is beautiful. It is, oh my God, I'm going to break this. Because it just looks so fragile. And in fact, the legend in the family is all about this. There is the idea that if the cup be broken, then the luck will flee from Eden Hall. And the family, perhaps recklessly, perhaps wisely, I would favour the first of those, gave it to British Museum. So the V&A now have this. You can go in and look at a fairy artifact on display. Let's hope they're a little bit more careful with that than they have been with some other objects.
Portland vase comes to mind.
Mm.
But you see it as fragile. I've seen other examples of this enameled Syrian glass, and it looks fairly sturdy to me. And it has a nice protective leather case, which has the IHS monogram on it, perhaps to keep it from fleeing back to fairyland. I don't know if that would stop it or not.
I have to disagree, Chris. This is not something I would give to my 9-year-old daughter to carry up the stairs.
No, of course not.
Even in a protective case. Anyway, we can agree it's a lovely object. But the story itself of an ancestor stealing a cup from the fairies is really quite well established, not just in Britain,
yes. But
also on the Isle of Man and also throughout parts of Northern Europe. In fact, we really need someone who knows English, who can deal with the Manx sources, but who knows German and maybe Dutch as well, to go through all these accounts and map them through Europe, because this is a story we get again and again. And I think I'm right in saying the earliest attestation is from before the luck of Eden Hall, the cup, was made. It's from 13th century Northern Yorkshire. And this is another Yorkshire family. And the ancestor of a local aristocratic family was riding through the night and got to Willy Know, which is one of the local fairy mounds, heard a noise, saw some fairies having a good time, and rushed in with his horse, grabbed a cup, and rode off with it, with the fairies furiously behind him. And in the end, this became an heirloom in the family. And if I remember correctly, they foolishly, this is the medieval equivalent of giving it to the V&A, gave it to the King of England, who I seem to remember then gave it to the King of Scotland as a gift. So there you are.
I thought it was given by William, King of the Scots, to Henry II.
So it went the other way. It must have gone from the Yorkshire family, God knows how, to the King of Scotland, and then down to the English monarch.
Tangled pedigrees of these things.
Yes. So we have fairy cups. Are there any other more valuable fairy artifacts? This is where I start to run out of knowledge. Can you think of any fairy jewelry, perhaps?
Loads of fairy jewelry, fairy crowns and fairy brooches. And this was from Scandinavia mostly. And it's a recurring element of fairy fashion that we think of fairy queens and fairy princesses as wearing crowns. And I look at this as, again, conflating the Virgin Mary with the fairy queen and with the virgin bride. You have a fairy crown for all those entities. There's a tradition of wedding crowns for brides in Scandinavia going back to at least the 16th century. It's made of precious metals. It's set with gems. It's called the brudekrona in Norway. And the custom is said to have arisen out of votive crowns given to statues of the Virgin Mary. The crown symbolized the bride's purity, and any maiden who'd romped in the midsummer twilight wasn't allowed to wear one, unless her family atoned by paying for a crown's refurbishment. And the people made very snarky comments about, wow, that's a fancy crown, must have some slutty girls in this parish. Anyway, bridal crowns weren't the exclusive property of the Christians. If old tales are to be believed, the Huldrefolk possessed wedding crowns. And they were clever metal workers. They had all kinds of gold and silver and gemstones in their subterranean caves. And Like fairies in Ireland and Scotland, the Huldra folk were said to aggressively abduct and seduce humans. They were believed to be stunningly seductive in spite of having a cow's tail, and their victims couldn't resist, but they'd never be the same again. And engaged girls caught between maidenhood and marriage were particularly vulnerable. A male Huldra would assume the appearance of a young woman's betrothed, and suddenly she'd find herself swept into preparations for a troll wedding. One recently engaged girl was alone at a mountain farm, and she thought her sweetheart came in, sat down, and started talking about having the wedding right away. People began to come into the hut, setting the table with silver and food. Bridesmaids dressed her in a beautiful wedding gown and placed the wedding crown upon her head. She was lucky her dog noticed something was wrong. It went straight down to Melbustad and there barked until her sweetheart took his gun and went up to the farm. Peeking through a crack, he could tell there were trolls and Huldra folk, and so he fired his gun over the roof. The door flew open. All the Huldra fled, leaving the girl sitting there in her bridal crown. The silver was still on the table, but all the food had turned into things like moss and dung and toadstools. So he took her down to the village and they held the wedding while she was all wearing the wedding finery, the Huldra folk, and the crown and the finery were supposedly hung up at the church at Melbustad, and they're supposed to be there to this day. I would love to know. I haven't been able to locate them. There were another silver crown from Norway was gotten when a young man kidnapped a Huldra maiden from her own wedding. And a young woman got a silver wedding brooch when, after being dressed for a Huldra wedding, she crossed her hands over her breast and said, "Cross in Jesus' name." And the Huldra folk tore off her bridal finery as fast as they could, but they couldn't take the silver brooch because her hands were crossed over it. Too bad she didn't snag the crown as well. Now, these large brooches were a feature of Norwegian wedding attire, and I've seen it suggested that the large amounts of metal were supposed to keep off trolls. And looking at the filigree and the knot patterns in some of the brooches, they may have had those powers where a supernatural entity would have to trace the pattern before claiming the wearer. But I would love to know, there are surviving crowns that are claimed to have been taken from the Huldra folk. And I'd like to know why these are attached only to certain crowns. Were they unusually old? Or had they been previously used to crown a statue of the Virgin Mary, giving them some sort of supernatural aura?
Chris, if that were the case, and that they came from a statue of Blessed Virgin Mary, in what circumstances would the crown get detached from the statue? How would that work?
I'm not clear on how Scandinavia became Protestant as opposed to Catholic. But at that time, churches were changed and the statues were removed. And if you had a valuable statue crown, you would sell it as they did in England when, you know, the monasteries were dissolved.
Interesting, interesting.
It's been said that alien and fairy abductions are virtually identical. And the Huldra folk seem just as obsessed as the alien greys with seduction and kidnapping, although they're more eager than the aliens to commit to marriage. But it's a sad commentary on the loss of the old traditions that today's alien abductors leave behind just implants and lost time instead of lovely silver bridal crowns. It's just so unfair.
Yeah. I was just thinking whether in the fairy census, we now have 1,000 records. Are there examples of fairies leaving gifts? And I think there are a couple. I can think of a couple involving jewellery where someone has decided that an item of jewellery has come thanks from the fairies.
Yes. I had meant to go through the census and look for that, and I ran out of time. So I think we need to trawl through the census and see what people say they've been given.
I mean, trying
of course, they wouldn't be talking about it, would they?
Well, they shouldn't be, that's for sure. To be fair, the person who described a piece of jewellery, it was her friend who wrote in. So maybe that's legally just okay, though we're in a grey area.
That's true.
You talked at the beginning, you said something about the fairies giving or being taken from the fairies. And from what I can see, the objects that we've talked about are overwhelmingly objects that are stolen from the fairies.
They seem to be, yes.
The only object that you've told me about that seems to not be in that category is the Huldra cloth from Iceland that was paid for midwife work. And thinking about it, in a British context, when the midwife goes to the fairies, she is often paid to at the end. And sometimes the payment is illusory, sometimes it's real. It depends. But that, so there's a kind of a parallel there for Britain. But most of the objects we're talking about are objects that are stolen. And I think it's fair that maybe just by way of health warning, we should advise our listeners not to do that.
Yeah, that's probably the sensible thing. I mean, it's not good to, you know, steal anything, but there are some cases. There was some fairies gave Morgan Rhys a fairy harp. A shepherd gave a shirt to wrap a baby up and afterwards would find a silver coin in a day in his clog shoe. So I don't know. It's not, I covered mostly things that were stolen from the fairies, and it's not a good idea. But what are we supposed to give the fairies ourselves? You know, some brownies or other household spirits will walk off the job in a huff if they're thanked or fed or given clothes. And then there's other categories that they won't work without at least one of those things. So it's kind of hard to know. It's kind of a capricious problem.
I've said this before to you, but I always find the fairies fascinating in that they clearly have a rules-based system. It's just we don't understand the rules. It's part of the sense of disorientation we get whenever we come into contact with their folklore.
And the rules do seem to change in a rather arbitrary manner. So
now I'm going to ask you, Chris, about any further reading, and I've got a smile on my face because I have something up my sleeve that I know you don't know about. So okay. For once, I'm going to come out on top, I think. Let's see. What have you got in terms of further reading?
I'm not aware of a single source on fairy artifacts. And that, you know, that said, here, you need to write another book. Do a book on fairy artifacts. There are lots and lots of blog posts and bits and bobs that have to be ferreted out of larger works of folklore. I mean, there's a chapter in Janet Board's Fairies, Real Encounters with Little People. I've written on the fairy crowns and a couple of other things. You've written some blog posts. British Fairies has a couple of posts called Rewards and Fairies, Gifts from the Good Neighbors.
This is John Cruise's website, okay. Yes.
And he's written about transactions with the fairies. So I'm just not aware of a single source. So if you've got something, please trot it out.
Well, I think you rushed a little bit quickly over your own work there. Your work on crowns has been published in the Fairy Investigation Society newsletter. And while that periodical is perhaps not the most prestigious, it's a lovely article. I think it was perhaps 5-6 years ago now. We must put that up when we go through. But I remember enjoying that. I've got this right, haven't I, Chris?
Oh, yes, yes. I wrote on the occasion of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's wedding.
So there you are. We can even date it. The other thing that I can mention is that in preparing for this episode, I read a fabulous article, really enjoyable, by John Mackley on the fairy flag of Dunvegan. And in fact, I stole from John's article a wonderful Walter Scott quote that you managed to get out before me. Curse you, Chris. But John's article is coming out in the June number of the Fairy Investigation Society newsletter. And I should say that the Fairy Investigation Society newsletter, the last two numbers, all members of the Fairy Investigation Society get a digital version, but the last two numbers have also come out as in print, and they can be purchased on Amazon. And really, for what it is, it's very cheap. If you're listening to this after June, I very, very much hope that John's excellent article will be out by then. We say too often, you need a book. But if you were going to write a book on this, I mean, who could we? You would need, even 5 or 6 chapters. I could write a chapter perhaps on fairy shoes. What could you contribute?
Well, just the fairy crowns, I think, and the fabric. I'd love to be able to actually track down that piece of fabric in Iceland.
Maybe an email would be interesting there.
I did try a number of years ago, but didn't have any result. But the language, there is a language barrier, and I would wonder if there aren't other fairy artifacts in museums or small collections in Iceland, because there's such a strong tradition there.
I do like this idea of the book, and perhaps if we could persuade John to contribute his article on the flag. We're almost halfway to a book. So if there were, say, 3 or 4 other people listening to this who had a good idea for a chapter on fairy artifacts, I have an article that I've been meaning to publish for quite a while on Elfshot.
I was just going to say Elfshot would be another chapter. And in fact, I have a photograph of a woman in the probably 1880s wearing a brooch with a large flint arrowhead with tiny elf shot dangling from it.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen the photograph you're talking about, but I've seen examples where elf shot is set in jewelry,
yes,
or set in a necklace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a very good article by Jessica Hemming on fairy cattle. And we talked before that this is a slightly different category. But so there are some things you could start to put together. I mean, a book sounds a great idea. I would love to write an appendix on fairy feet in a chapter on fairy shoes.
And there would be a whole chapter on fairy bodies, because there's all of these faux dead mermaids and pressed fairies and fairy skeletons. Yeah, there's a lot of information out there on these faux fairy corpses.
You could actually do an up-to-date reference there, because there is that gentleman, Dan Baines, who in the 2010s created that very famous fairy hoax where you see a tiny skeleton with wings next to police tape.
Mm-hmm.
And this was published successfully in a local British paper and then picked up by all the nationals. And it became one of those early melt the internet moments where everyone was swapping the image around.
Yeah.
So it's not your typical artifact, but the photograph, in a sense, the image has become an artifact. So, I think that's a really, really great idea.
Oh, you've also got that mummified gnome.
What's the mummified gnome? Forgive me.
Oh, gosh. It's another, made up figure. And I'm not sure who, if anybody's actually examined it, but I've seen it floating around. It's got a little coffin and it's got one of the top, it's got a peaked red hat and a beard, and it's kind of sinister looking because it's all dried up. But it's supposed to be a mummified gnome.
Well, so there you are. We've got to have something on fairy bodies too. Chris, I've really enjoyed talking about fairy artifacts. As always, talking with you, I feel I know quite a lot more at the end than I did at the beginning. Do you want to play us out with one of your readings?
I will do that. This story was from Wales, and originally it appeared in Croker's Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland. I don't know why it was in that particular book. But the shorter version appeared in The Fairy Mythology by Thomas Keatley, 1850. Guido, who was a fine boy, used often to ramble to the top of the mountain to look after his father's sheep. On his return, he would show his brothers and sisters pieces of remarkably white paper, like crown pieces with letters stamped upon them, which he said were given to him by the little children with whom he used to play on the mountain. One day, he did not return. And during 2 whole years, no account could be got of him, and the other children were beginning to go up to the mountain and bring back some of those white crown pieces. At length, one morning as their mother opened the door, she saw Guido sitting on the threshold with a bundle under his arm. He was dressed and looked exactly as when she had last seen him. To her inquiry of where he had been for so long a time, He replied it was only the day before he had left her, and he bade her look at the pretty clothes the little children on the mountain had given him for dancing with them to the music of their harps. The dress in the bundle was a very white paper, without seam or sewing. The prudent mother committed it to the flames.
You've been listening to Bogger and Banshee, a Supernatural podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please leave a review, as it helps other people find us. Those cursed algorithms.